Accession number 29953, reel 6.
We set off coming back, do the same thing all the way back. Which we still got to go across that tree trunk that was across the that was one bad thing, but went down the river, and we were just about to turn up to go back up to the Long Acre when some people from Long Acre came down, and we joined them. And from then on, the actual invasion had started. So our job was to go down the river and deal with anything that we could deal with. There was only about five or six of the main thing there, but another party had been dropped in, as they were actually British, a major and three sergeants, and the powers that be had decided that the party I was with weren't killing enough Japs, and we didn't want to kill Japs, we just wanted to find out what was all going on to be ready. But they had been sent in, and they were going to be killing everybody right, left and centre, as far as I could make out, and had been sent on their own to do it because Toby Carter wasn't going to do it. But they started killing the wrong people, so Toby Carter had to get them back and insisted on them staying with us and doing what he said. The other chap was a major as well, but that was it. And we just moved from there, went down the river. The Japs had withdrawn a lot of their troops to be together to combat the invasion, which had started on the Bowen Island and then on the mainland. And we finally finished up down at the only town in the area. There were some Japs there, but when they heard we were coming, they cleared out in that way. And it was Marudi is the name of the actual town there, if it was Mjolet town. And we camped there, where there was a big bungalow we had and all the rest of it, and it was fine. But then the Japs decided that they didn't like us being there, and they came back in force. They must have taken their troops away from somewhere else to come up and deal with us. But we got word of them going to do this, but in advance. So we thought we'd ambush them on the way up, and we hadn't enough people to do very much. We had the two lots only, and of course this occasion, unusually, two small craft, they usually travel with a small scout craft, the main big craft, and then a small one at the back. In this case, the two small ones were first. So we killed all them, but the big one was started opening fire on us too, so we decided it wasn't very healthy, so we came away. We had canoes planted at another end of the village, and we got them and went up river. We had left the two of the British NCOs just to cover us going that way, but to drop back as soon as we were well away from the village. However, they waited, and the Japs started coming up the pathway towards where we would have been, and they opened fire on them and killed a whole lot of them, and then came back. So Toby Carter was standing next to his canoe, and I was standing next to mine, until these two NCOs came running and got in. And just as we were going to get in, there was a yell from further up, and there was a group of persons coming towards us, and this was two Indian Sikhs had managed to escape, but were so weak they couldn't walk, and there was four persons more or less carrying these two. So Toby Carter took one in his canoe, and I took one in my canoe, and they were just absolutely exhausted, and just laid them on the ground and set off and went up river. They weren't followed or anything, and got up as far as we wanted to spend the night there. The chap in my canoe would never move for ages, and then I could see there was a slight movement, so he was still alive. He was away with it, and eventually he did really come to, and he eventually saw me, I don't think he believed his eyes, because I was in British Army uniform, sort of thing. And they finally got round to the fact that it was me. And then in the process of getting the chap who was in the canoe with me to start with, the wireless operator, he'd moved up to the very front, but he was always also the Bren gunner. And the Bren gun he'd left behind right next to where this chap was. And eventually, you know, he'd kind of nodded and that sort of thing. I could see he was still alive, and he must have put his hand down and felt this Bren gun, and he looked down at it. It was, you know, kind of shock sort of thing, and he looked at me, and so I realised he'd done that, and I just nodded to show him that it was a Bren gun. So he looked down and he started stroking it again, and he turned around. I've never seen such a wonderful smile on his face. It was gorgeous. And he spent the rest of the journey up there stroking this Bren gun. He couldn't have lifted it, he couldn't have done anything with it. We just lifted them, two of them, out of the canoes when we got to where we were going to, put them on the kind of sandy gravel stuff, and we spent the night just next to them and that sort of thing. But we made contact by radio with the headquarters, and they sent in a Catalina the next day, picked them up.
Where were the prison camps?
The main prison camp was down south of where we were, quite a bit down, oh God, memory. The prison camp otherwise, which was a cause of one of the troubles, was north-east of where we were. I could probably find it in the map, I doubt it. And the Australians had made a feint to make it look like the invasion was taking place further east than that, as it was. So the Jap troops who had been there decided they couldn't repel it, and they set off to move westwards to join up with the rest of the Japs, and doing so came past this prisoner of war camp which was there, and a whole lot had died already from disease, malnutrition and so on. So they decided, as the prisoner of war camp guards, they were joining in with the others. So the prisoners who couldn't walk were killed there on the spot. The rest of us, the rest of them, all set off walking. Not long after they started, two managed to escape one night. Then we continued, and us people were exhausted. They couldn't get up, so they just bayoneted where they lay or shot. And this kept going on day after day, apparently. I wasn't with them. This is all what was in the book about it. And until they finally joined up with the rest of the Japs at one part. I think there's only a handful still alive after that. Well, it was one of these death marches which happened and that sort of thing. It was a ghastly thing. And that was how it was working in that side of it. But this was had happened there. As far as I was concerned, we had been at Maroodi. We got chased out of Maroodi. The Australians said they would come in and deal with them, which they did. They had rocket launchers and everything, and the Japs eventually just cleared out. So we took over there, got ourselves back in where we'd been sleeping before, and the Australians turned around and said, but we can't stay here, because somebody has drawn a line on the map as to how far we must go and no further, and you're on the wrong side of the line. So they had to camp out a bit away from us in swampy, not very nice things, instead of being with us in a village in Nibble Mod Con, which was okay. We kind of just waited to see what was all happening everywhere. We were just not sure whether the Japs would attack us again or not, but they didn't. And then we got word that the Japs in another place further west from where we had been had cut across country and were actually north of us, and in the same village that I had been in and having walked across before. So we set off to deal with them if we could. But just before we set off, we got the news that the Japs had surrendered. So there was no urgency. So Toby Carter was known to all the people there. He had been living in that part of Borneo for a long time, and he knew the head men and so on. So he entertained them one night, and then we set off again to go up to try and find where the other Japs were. The war was over by that time. We got up to where I had been, they were supposed to have been, but they had moved on, and they'd burnt the village down to the ground. So all the village people were living just in the jungle. Toby Carter arranged for a drop of food and milk for the children, and blankets to give some covering. And we were just still milling around there. We were going to go up after the Japs because they weren't all that much ahead of us, and they would have to go through a narrow pass, which if the party to the east of us wanted to, they could block one end and we could block the other end. And we sent the messengers to do that, and just then a canoe with one white man on it came up, and he was a lieutenant colonel in the British Army. He had come to take me back to headquarters because the wireless officer in charge there was no longer there, and I was to take over from him. Of course, everybody was furious at him. I've never seen a lieutenant colonel be sworn at so hard in Australia. It was gorgeous. But he was insistent that I had to go back with him. So rather than create too much of a fuss, I went back with him. We never spoke. I was going to speak to him. He tried to make conversation. He had been there out in the Borneo before the war, knew everybody and everything. But he hadn't been doing any war stuff. He was, now that the war was over, he was there to resume his normal position on that side. So we went downriver. We spent the night at a longhouse going down. He asked me if I minded stopping the night. That was just one polite thing. I said, I'll stop for a week here rather than go back. But you know, he stuck with me all the time. You couldn't go out for to relieve yourself or anything. He was going to accompany you too. He didn't want to lose me, and that was it. I got back down to Marudi, and then I was put out. There was a seaplane waiting at Catalina. Flew me out back to the headquarters just off the coast of Borneo, and that was it.
Did you see the Seamap 2 party again?
Not really. I saw none of the one, didn't even see any of the Seamap 2 party again then. I think I met the odd one after that. But not then. We never caught up together. I was there. I don't know what happened. You see, the war was over. If you can get a lift back to Australia, that's it. There was no rhyme or reason to it. I found them all very nice working with them. And we heard that there was a big prisoner of war camp not far away. And they had tried to get the Japs to release the British, Australian, etc. prisoners, but they wouldn't do it. And we toyed with the idea of having a parachute drop into them, but that was ruled out. And eventually they did capitulate, and a hospital ship called in there and picked up all the British and Australian personnel and took them back up to us, and we cleared the hospital of everybody but them. And I knew they were coming and heard about it, weren't paying too much attention. And three Australians came along in a jeep and said, we know that there's some British been picked up, and we are going to visit the Australians who were with them in the prisoner of war camp. If you would like, there's a seat for you, which is very nice. So I went with them and went to the prisoner of war camp. So it was not the prisoner of war camp. It was the hospital there. They went in to see the Australians, and I went in to see the British. So we had about an hour going around the beds, chatting to them. They were in a terrible state. And then went back. They would be evacuated in time. And I just stayed there. They wanted to know how the signals worked. This was the local Sarawak people and that sort of thing, which I was quite happy to tell them all about it. There was the base station which we were using was a mixture of Australian and New Zealand and British. They could do their work quite easily. And I explained how we had been working and the sets we were using and everything else. And eventually, the British chap came out to relieve me. I didn't know he was coming, and nobody had said it. I would see myself being stuck there for a year because there was nothing else you could do about it. The British wouldn't let me go, and that was it. So he eventually came, and I was able to go. We had about one night together there and get on a plane and get out of the place as soon as possible back to Australia.
What is your how effective do you think the SEMA?
Well, I think it was very effective, our side of it. I won't argue about any of the others, but we were there to gather intelligence and to find out what was all happening and to pass the all information until such time as we might do something worthwhile from a fighting point of view. And one of the other things that had happened was at an earlier stage, when this invasion was really well on the way, made a parachute drop to us of 100 rifles and ammunition and so on. 50 was for us and 50 was for the SEMAT 1 party, which was fine. I wasn't there at the time. I was on my way to the other thing, and Toby Carter, the officer for SEMAT 1, said that they were completely surrounded by Japs, and unless they got the 100 rifles...
Tom Harrison.
Unless they got the 100 rifles, they would be wiped out. Well, Toby Carter was faced up with this. We were safe, we could manage, we could do everything without them. So he sent the 100 rifles instead of 50. Of course, Tom Harrison was nowhere near any Japs. He just wanted 100 rifles, full stop. That's the sort of thing Tom Harrison was. He had to be the big one, so he had to have everything, you know. No, I have no time for Tom Harrison.
In his memoirs, you can detect a bit of tension between him and Toby Carter.
Oh, we wouldn't have anything to do with him.
Yeah.
And neither would Bill Sochin, who was next to us in the other way. Tom wanted us all to join together, but the other two said, no, thank you, we're not having anything to do with you. We're finished, nothing to do with it. He was a showman, and that was all it was about it. He probably did some fighting and so on, but he had things organised. Operation SEMAT 1 is a good read by some of the people who were in SEMAT 1 as opposed to us in SEMAT 2. They have no good word to say about Tom. None at all. And actually, the funny thing is, there's the book about the SEMAT operations I'm in.
This is Courtney's book, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Yes, yeah. It's really straightforward and all the rest of it, but it's just this knowledge that, as far as Tom was concerned, he had to be the big man, and he kept moving people about for no reason at all, as far as I could see. None of his own people said a good word for him at any time, and it was pathetic. That's all you could say about it. And of course Jumbo Courtney fell for him because he laid on everything that he had done and all the rest of it, and he actually didn't get his book published. He was going to have the book published of ours, but he couldn't get a publisher, and I'd been in touch with him already about something or other, and he wrote to me and asked if I knew of a publisher who might do it, and I said I had no connection with publishers at all in Britain, but what, as far as I could make out, he had done the book being done by the SEMAT 1 party. It was a load of rubbish. So I think Jumbo amended what he would have said about them, because he doesn't say anything against them, but he doesn't say a lot for them. Mm-hmm. He realised after a bit that there's a whole lot of just eyewash and that sort of thing. I mean, Tom Harrison had to be the best and everything else, whereas the others all did it. Toby Carter never made any... he wrote a small bit himself for the book and that sort of thing, but he wasn't going to boast about anything. Bill Sochin, who was south of us, he gave a good write-up for the things, but And Jumbo must have amended what he had originally done for Seamount 1 quite a bit. I was very pleased to see that.
What was Toby Carter like?
Very nice. He wasn't a soldier, let's put it that way. He had been with a petroleum company. He was a gentleman, to start with. But he would listen to anybody. He would listen to anything that was being said and was very nice. I mean, he wouldn't yell at anybody to speak of except some of the locals if they were being awkward. And he could give the odd ones a good telling off about some things. But in general, he was a gentleman, and he had been high up in the petroleum side, and that was it. As I say, he wasn't really a soldier as such, but we did very well with him. And we could see no point in going and killing half a dozen Japs for no reason at all and putting your own life at risk in doing it. You were there to get information, direct things and do things, get the local people on your side, get them to support you and all that side of it. It's just one of these situations.
And how did you find the local people to live with? And
oh, great. Wonderful. Wonderful people. Couldn't get better. They really were. And they were good fun. They're really good fun. I can remember coming back from the trip that I'd been on and I had to come back from, didn't see anybody there, and we had to spend this night. It wasn't far to go to get home, but it would be dark and they didn't want to go, so we're about three or four in the afternoon in this long house, and they all got together, a great circle. It must have been about 30 of us in a circle on the veranda, and the women came along with drinks and all this sort of stuff. Well, there it was, just having a general chat and so on. And they, of course, they always have their own cigarettes or cigars, which they rolled themselves. They got a medium-sized bit of leaf and a whole lot of crumbly stuff, and they fold it up, and it's narrow at the mouth end and gets bigger at the other end. And they were all smoking this, and of course, it passed me by because I don't smoke. And a person at the far end, a lady there, and she must have been a very important person because she was the only female there. She was old. I mean, she had only, you could see out of one eye only, and her tongue was bright crimson with chewing betel nut. Her breath were just lumps of skin. Of course, it was the sarong was still daylight, so it was worn low down, and the thing went past her. But she was always laying off to the people at her side. And when the stuff got to her and she had rolled her cigar, she suddenly noticed that I was not smoking. She held up the cigar to offer it to me. I did like this. No. And she looked at the cigar, looked at me, looked at the cigar. And one of the chaps halfway down had a great laugh. He said something in a very low, guttural voice. I knew it was a rude thing, but I didn't know what he said, and everybody burst out laughing. So there was one of the others there who could speak a little, and what I knew of Malay, it transpires that when a girl gets of age to have children, she's given a room of her own to entertain people, and she has a good look round to choose who she would want as a partner. And having chosen that person, she goes quietly and slips the stone into his hand without anybody else seeing. If he wants to take up that invitation, he keeps it. Otherwise, he drops it. But if he keeps it, that means that he will come up 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning to her room and spend the night. And this can go on as you want and that sort of thing. It changes once it became obvious that they're courting, more or less. So all she had to do was to roll a cigar and give it to any man that she was fancying. So this was a great hoot. I didn't want to take that cigar. I didn't want to spend the night with this female. The whole thing, everybody was roaring and laughing. And for the rest of that night, every time her eyes met mine, she went into great laughs and things. It was really quite funny, the whole thing. Quite a business.